Hello, and thank you for joining us. My name is Stuart Ellis, and I'm the producer of Sprott Radio. In a departure from our regular interviews, today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to focus on the economy and have a bit of a debate. Both of our debaters are well-versed in macroeconomics and spend their days going deep into the data to conduct their research. My understanding is they agree on some things and less so on others. So we hope to cover a lot of ground, have a spirited debate, and hear some interesting points of view. With that, I'll pass it over to our moderator. He's a senior portfolio manager, a veteran investor in the gold space, and most importantly, a key member of the Sprott team. He's our very own John Hathaway. John, I'll hand it over to you to introduce our guests and get the ball rolling.
Thanks, Stuart. Good morning, everybody. This morning we have Luke Grohman, founder of FFT, a macro research firm. And then we also have Don Luskin, who's the CEO and founder of Trend Macro, a global macro research firm serving clients all over the world. So let's start, guys, with your thoughts on inflation, deflation, disinflation, and all that sort of thing. And Luke, why don't you go first?
Thanks, John. It's great to be here. My outlook for inflation slash deflation is that inflation is really the only thing keeping the U.S. Treasury market functioning and the U.S. government effectively solvent. The U.S. with debt to GDP at 120+% needs sustained negative real interest rates. In other words, rates need to be below inflation. This was talked about in great detail, actually, last summer in a white paper on the St. Louis Fed website by Charles Kalamiris. He wrote in there that positive 2% real rates would quickly put the U.S. into fiscal dominance almost immediately. We saw positive 2% real rates in July 2023 for a moment, and the long bond, USTLT ETF, crashed 20% in the third quarter. So to me, it's likely to be volatile and uneven, but I think we are in a new era of secularly higher inflation out of political necessity, which is to say you need negative real interest rates to sustain the U.S. government's debt level.
Great. Okay, Don, what is your thought on the subject?
Well, somebody should tell the U.S. government all that. Because let's say it's true. We have right now none of the preconditions for the government delivering that great blessing and favor unto itself. We have a Fed that is telling us, yes, they've pivoted from the fire-breathing rate hikes that they were doing in 2022, but you know, they've had the Fed funds rate at 5 3/8, the highest rate in 17 years since the July FOMC meeting. And markets don't expect they're going to make the first cut until the June FOMC meeting. And they're not saying anything to disabuse the market of that. In the meantime, we're experiencing the first year-over-year outright decline in the M2 money supply in the history of the data that goes all the way back to 1959. Now, the world's a complicated place, but if I had to cite a single simple rule for a complex world, it would be Milton Friedman's famous dictate that inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. So with, you know, some degree of precision and some degree of imprecision and some unknown lag and, you know, all the usual health warnings, it's one of the most durable relationships in economics that inflation, the change in the price level, follows the change in the money supply, with something of a lag, you know, anywhere, say, between 12 months and 24 months. So with the money supply in not just growing below normal, but outright shrinking for the first time ever, well, you know, any sensible model is going to tell you that at least in the next couple of years, we're going to have the opposite of what Luke says we need. Already, CPI, if you take out OER, owner's equivalent rent, the largest part, the laggiest part, the statistically most invalid part, if you take that out, already CPI is back to 2%. Core CPI is back to 2.4. They've been there for months. Now, expressed in CPI terms, the Fed's target is 2.5. They've been below target for the better part of a year. Large parts of CPI, especially the goods parts, are already in downright year-over-year minus sign deflation. So, if that turns out to be true, and if Luke's premises are correct, we're facing a kind of disaster. It's not going to be an inflationary disaster. It's going to be the opposite. It's going to be a deflationary disaster.
I would certainly agree with the logic of what you just said. It would not only just be disinflation, it would be deflation and a credit bust, which I would think politically is totally unpalatable, and I expect that that would force the Fed into warp speed as far as money creation. I know, and I think, Don, you both feel that the economy doesn't face that sort of reckoning, that we're going to have a soft landing or maybe just stick a landing without any interruption economically. And yet your view is that with this contraction of M3 and all the other aspects that would lead to a contraction of economic activity, we're not going to have a contraction of economic activity. We're going to sail along without a real blip in GDP. Luke, I think you're in the same place, but for different reasons. So I'd kind of like to explore that.
The reason I don't think we're going to get a downward trend in GDP is, I think, ultimately, when I look at what is happening with the fiscal deficit situation and federal government spending, it has bottomed and is already rising again, notably. And I think that's our leading indicator on what money supply is ultimately going to do. And the reason I say that is because unless the government cuts that spending, someone needs to finance that spending, and the balance sheet isn't there. So we could get another one of these cycles that we have had for the past, five times in the past 4 years. Anytime you get the deficit into not enough balance sheet capacity, you get the U.S. government crowding out global dollar markets, the dollar starts to rise, and we quickly get into a treasury market problem. The first one was in September 2019 when we saw repo rates spike to 8 to 10%. The Fed very quickly came in, began regrowing their balance sheet at a period of time where no one thought they were going to do it, except for us and a few others. March of 2020, we saw the brief deflationary spike around COVID. At the bottom of it, the treasury market crashed. Stan Druckenmiller's words, something he said in 40 years he had never seen. Treasury market crashed. Fed comes in, $600 billion a week in QE until things sort of get stabilized. After the Fed started tightening, the third instance of treasury market dysfunction was September 2022. Very quickly, it wasn't the Fed this time. We thought it would be the Fed. We were wrong. It was Treasury. Yellen began running down the TGA so fast that she more than offset the tightening impact of the Fed's QT and rate hikes. And she ran down the dollar, and that supplied liquidity to the system. 1Q23 was the fourth instance where we saw the banking system get upside down in their treasuries, and the Fed could have said, nope, sell them at losses to supply money to supply deposit losses, but the Fed didn't. The Fed instead did what was effectively yield curve control for the U.S. banking system and engaged in swaps at par on treasuries that were trading probably 30% below par for the U.S. banking system, supplying more liquidity yet again when the treasury market started dysfunctioning. And the fifth episode in 4 years was in October of just this past year, where we again saw treasury market dysfunction. We saw 7 Fed speakers in 10 days. Jawbone the dollar down like they were reading from a hymnal. The bond market has done our job for us. They all said basically the same thing. Yellen comes in, shifts issuance from the long end to the front end. The point to all of this is we've seen 5 times in 4 years that anytime the treasury market gets dysfunctional, the Fed and Treasury respond very quickly with liquidity. If you have a decline in money monetary base and an increase in U.S. government spending, you are going to have Treasury dysfunction very quickly, and they're going to respond very quickly with the liquidity. And so I think it's really interesting that we're already seeing signs of that liquidity being addressed. We've seen the rundown in reverse repo. That's supplying liquidity in the interim. Yellen has TGA that can be run down after that. But we saw a couple weeks ago ISDA, the too big to fail banking lobbyist effectively, write a letter to the Fed, the FDIC, and the OCC asking for permanent exemptions to the SLR rule for treasuries. This is simply yield curve control, or QE, executed through the bank. I agree with Don that if money supply goes down, it is negative. Where I disagree with him is that for it to be continued negative, the Fed and or Treasury have to stand aside and let the Treasury market dysfunction. And then not just dysfunction, but you have to start allowing Treasury auction fails, which is just never going to be allowed in our country, in my view. So we can see the signs being set up for more dollar liquidity, reverse repo rundown, then we'll get the TGA rundown. And then you're seeing preparations for changes to the rules that we last saw during the COVID crisis, this exemption to bank SLR requirements to buy treasuries, which is effectively QE or yield curve control executed by the banks. And that will then supply the dollar liquidity. And that's why I think the deficit in the U.S. government spending in particular, which as U.S. government spending has bottomed and is now rising very meaningfully on a trailing 12-month basis off the lows, is your leading indicator for a rise in money supply. Because, yeah, could it cause problems in the short run with a decline in money supply? Sure. However, unless these authorities are willing to stand aside and let the treasury market dysfunction again, more dollar liquidity will come. The money base will then begin growing very rapidly to finance the rising U.S. government spending.
Okay, so a lot of information there, but I think the bottom line is that deficit spending will rise as necessary to keep the economy afloat, and the Fed and the Treasury will do what they can to assure smooth functioning liquidity in the Treasury market. Don, I think you see things a little bit differently. I think you feel debt is not the issue that Luke has made it out to be, and that economic growth will basically address and solve what at least currently appears to many people a real issue, which is the overhang of U.S. Treasury debt and continuing deficits. So
right.
maybe kind of go through all that and respond to Luke's points.
I'm not going to be able to respond to Luke's points because you made so many of them. You know, you've compressed a huge number of sub-stories into a larger overarching story. You know, you have stories about Janet Yellen and the Treasury and the Fed and ISDA and everybody, you know, you seem to know what their intentions are and act as though they can carry out those intentions with great perfection. We could spend the next 3 hours taking a transcript of what you said, and I could probably find 20 assumptions that you've made and push back on them. I don't think that would be particularly profitable to do. Let me say, just as a overarching point, that it seems to me that your view of the world, at least the one that you just expressed, is one where you think the only thing that matters that's worth mentioning are the machinations of these institutions. And I didn't hear one single word in that narrative about anything going on in the private sector or the real economy. And I'm going to use an expression here, and I guess it's inevitably a pejorative expression. I can't quite come up with another one, but please accept when I say it, I don't mean it to sound pejorative. You have an interlocking series of what amount to lowercase c conspiracy theories, where there are these agents who, you know, in a sort of hidden but very powerful way are pulling the strings of the world. Now, that may be true, but it's not the only thing going on in the world at all. You know, we had an economic crisis in the pandemic where the entire global economy was shut down anywhere from 3 months to a year. We had fluctuations in economic variables like GDP growth, like unemployment, the likes of which haven't been seen since the 30s. So, you know, I remember people were saying during the so-called Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, oh, this is the worst thing since the Depression. Yeah, but, you know, almost orders of magnitude different, right? So in the Great Recession, over a year and a half, we saw a 3.5% drop in GDP. Okay. Well, we saw a 10% drop in GDP in 3 months during the pandemic. That was a depression. It was also a war. So it was a depression and the solution to the depression. Just like in the Great Depression of the 30s, its solution was World War II. That was not only the greatest public works program ever conceived by the mind of man, but it was a complete restart of the global economy, a massive investment in new technologies, which the world spent the next 20 years adopting. So, for instance, jet aircraft were invented in World War II. Every combatant had them. They were on the field in 1945. There weren't very many of them. Didn't make a difference. But 5 years later, the British de Havilland Company was testing, and then 2 years after that, so 7 years after VE Day, de Havilland was putting in the air the Constellation, the first passenger jet. So the fact that we're recording this podcast this way, the fact that we have a work from home revolution, a live anywhere you want revolution, you know, even someday these damn mRNA vaccines are probably going to prove to be incredibly valuable. And we had a chance to test them on billions of guinea pigs, right or wrong. This is a technology revolution coming out of a war, just like coming out of World War II. This was the best war ever. because this wasn't man against man, and we didn't destroy the world's physical plant like we did in World War II. This was all men together working against an alien, invisible invader. And when you come out of an experience like that, not only are you armed with whole new ways of interacting with people, interacting with your work, new technologies you can use, but you're a warrior, man. If you survived that, you're going to mourn your dead, and you're a warrior, and you're going to act accordingly. You can say what you want about the Fed and the Treasury's general account and ISDA and all this stuff. And if you leave out the fact that we have been through the biggest business cycle fluctuation in 90 years, but compressed it into 3 months, oh my God, you're missing the story.
Wow. Okay. So in your mind, the story is the productivity revolution that's taking place that was brought about by COVID. I would surmise from what you've said that we don't need to worry about the exchange value of the U.S. dollar versus other currencies, that the economy being strong, the dollar will seek its level and will not be a problem in terms of public policy. Luke, I'm basically asking a question on what you see for the future trading value of the U.S. dollar vis-a-vis other currencies, and the most important currency of all, gold bullion.
I think it's a great metaphor to use that Don highlighted regarding World War II. And so let's go with that. At the end of World War II, roughly 3 to 6% of the world's population was dead. The U.S. was basically the only developed nation, industrial nation in the world, whose industrial base had not been destroyed by war. The U.S. was basically the only nation whose working population of young men was intact largely, certainly relative to places like the Soviet Union, Germany, Japan. Then compare that to today. I agree we fought a war. I think COVID was the last battle of what was a 30-year, 25-year trade war, economic war, and we lost that war. And the reason I know we lost that war is because in World War II, the people that lost a good portion of their industrial base. It had been bombed into oblivion. And then the United States had a boom as we basically rebuilt it for them, particularly, again, Germany and Japan. In contrast, without bombing, the United States, via trade policy, first via NAFTA, where we sent the factories to Mexico, and then via China into the WTO, where we sent those factories to China. The United States' industrial base this time, at the end of this war, quote-unquote war, is the one that has been severely impaired, which is fine. That's the growth opportunity that I agree exists. However, it's a very inflationary outcome. You're going to have to basically do some version of industrial policy, which is, I think, exactly why Trump started it in 2018 and Biden has continued it in 2020 and on. And both candidates are openly talking about varying degrees of industrial policy to rebuild that as well. And similarly, post-World War II, U.S. debt to GDP was 110%. What followed was a U.S. deleveraging its balance sheet by virtue of the Fed and Treasury, who got married in January of 1942, shortly after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. The Fed came out and said, we will buy every 10-year Treasury you issue at 2.5%. We will buy every three-month Treasury at 3/8%, no question asked. And the Fed's balance sheet grew 10x from 1942 to 1951. And with most of that growth during the war. So basically, there was the productivity or the giant public works project Don spoke of. He's right. And it was paid for by the Fed. And what happened was that you had rationing of goods in the war to contain inflation during the war. But after the war, rationing of goods went off and U.S. inflation rates exploded. U.S. real rates bottomed in 47 or 48 at negative 13%. We were the winner of the war, critically. In Japan, the loser of the war, real rates bottomed at negative 60%. In Italy, negative 40%. In Australia, who won, negative 30%. In other words, inflation ran anywhere from 13% above rates to as high as 60% above rates in Japan in war-ravaged countries, war-ravaged losing countries. And so the point here is that by letting U.S. real rates bottom at negative 13%, the U.S. debt to GDP went from 110% in 1945 to 55% by 1951, when there was something called the Fed Treasury Accord agreed to, which effectively was Fed and Treasury, Treasury saying, okay, Fed, you are independent again. War's over. Now you can run independent monetary policy. We don't need you to finance the biggest public works program in history anymore.
But we didn't get back to the pre-war debt to GDP ratio for another 13 years until 1964.
No, that's right. But it went from 110% in 45 to 55% by 51 by inflating away the debt, by the Fed inflating away the debt effectively. You can see that on the charts. And so the point here is that we just finished the war and we have lost a lot of our industrial base to that war. And our debt to GDP is 120%. And so you've got to get that down first. And if you want to do the public works projects to rebuild that industrial base to support the growth, then you're going to have to inflate that debt away in the same way that we did after World War II, using your metaphor.
Well, look, there were a couple high inflation years like 1949 and 1950 were, but 1950 also has the distinction. It has the distinction of being the height of post-war inflation at 9%, but it's also the single biggest real GDP year in American history at 13%. So, you know, you can have a single explanation and just say everything in the world depends on inflation, but no, it also has to do with the post-war boom, where in 1950, we had 13% GDP growth after you adjust for inflation. That really happened. You can't leave that out.
Importantly, why did we have that growth? I just said why we had that growth. Because Japan's industrial base was destroyed and we were building it. Because we were in a new Cold War with the Soviets, we were rebuilding it. We were running the Berlin Airlift. We were rebuilding Germany. It was American property.
How much did the Berlin Airlift contribute to GDP in 1950? You have no idea. The Berlin Airlift wasn't even in 1950.
No, it was in 1948.
Well, let me ask both of you, because we're talking about history here. What do both of you expect future deficits to look like, looking out this year and maybe over the next 5 years? Will they be resolved by economic growth, which I think would be Don's point of view, or may they continue to be on the order of trillions, which they are now, because of increased public spending and as much as productivity might help at this point in time, maybe not enough to keep those deficits at very high levels and therefore need for yield curve control.
Well, I hope we don't need yield curve control because central banks aren't really very good at it. You know, they talk a good game. But, you know, it's very different today than it was back in the, you know, war bond era of the 40s and early 50s. The private sector financial world is now, you know, it now basically just swamps what these government agents can do. So good luck with that. I hope they don't need it. But let me just say that, you know, part of the war metaphor is, you know, it's still early days. So, you know, if you think of World War II for the United States' purposes, you know, beginning on Pearl Harbor Day in December 7th, 1941, and think about that as, you know, sort of the onset of the COVID emergency. Well, you know, we're still right in that period. And the big jump in the debt to GDP ratio in this iteration, at least, was during that period when, you know, obviously the economy was contracting. So the denominator was falling, GDP was falling, and debt was rising because two presidents and two Congresses did $6 trillion worth of stimulus spending. So that's going to get your debt to GDP ratio really high because you're fighting a war. Now, versus that peak that it attained in 2020, it is now lower than that. It immediately fell back to something like 120, and within a percentage point, debt to GDP has been something like 118, 120, 121, steadily now for 3.5 years. Now, that can only be true if the debt is growing at approximately the same rate as the nominal economy. Now, all I can say is, you know, fine. I mean, we're here to look into our crystal balls and say what's going to happen in the future. And there are all kinds of reasons for, you know, thinking this could all go terribly, terribly wrong. But it's weirdly so far so good. It's amazing how we've stuck the landing on at least containing debt to GDP where it is right now. Now, by the way, I don't concede at all that debt GDP to GDP is particularly the right ratio. You know, people say it all the time. Respected economists like Rogoff and Reinhardt talk about the debt to GDP ratio all the time. Their most famous work on it was based in part on some very important computational errors that they were terribly embarrassed to have to correct 3 years after their book was published. But nevertheless, it's an insufficient metric to begin with. If Rogoff and Reinhardt were your Econ 101 teacher, they would actually flunk you for comparing a balance sheet item to an income statement item. What you probably want to do is you want to compare balance sheet items to balance sheet items. So that's what a mortgage banker does when you're applying for a jumbo mortgage. He says, well, what's the loan-to-value ratio? What's the debt-to-equity ratio in the United States? Sure, in dollar terms, in nominal dollar terms, federal debt is horrifying, especially if you're a conservative like me who wants the federal government to be smaller. So, you know, as a citizen, I think it's just absolutely ridiculous. It's horrible, not to be born. But as an economist, I'm going to be like a mortgage banker. I'm going to say, okay, what's your debt-to-equity ratio here? Do I want to issue this jumbo mortgage to you? Well, I don't know. What's the equity of the United States? Well, I guess its single most important item is the present value of its future taxing power. Well, what's that? Well, that's going to be very closely connected to the earnings power of the American economy in perpetuity, present valued. What's our best estimate of that? The market cap of the S&P 500. The ratio of the federal debt to the market cap of the S&P 500, which represents the present value of all the earnings potential in the United States forever, minus the debt, because this is market cap, well, that's about the lowest in 15 years. So that's not coming off the rails. And in fact, you know, for all these, you know, dire predictions, it's pretty hard to look at stuff that's coming off the rails. So, you know, Luke's mentioned the value of the dollar. I'm just going to talk about it on a trade weighted basis. If we were to look at it, say, versus the yen, well, we certainly don't need to worry about a dollar crisis, except maybe the dollar is too strong. But in the last 5 or 6 years, while all this is playing out, the dollar's just been in kind of the same range it's generally been in. For sure, Luke's absolutely right that we had a change in the value of long-term treasuries because interest rates went from the lowest in history on March 7th, 2000, to the highest in 15 years on October 18th, 2023. Well, when you have that kind of change happening that quickly, no question about it, your bonds are going to be underwater, especially if you bought them right at the top when everyone was panicking in March 2020. Well, gee, this is not the first time I've ever heard of people regretting they bought the top, right? But this case, it happens to be bonds. So, you know, you say all that, but where we are right now, having lived through that horrendous adventure that has hurt so many people who did the wrong thing at the wrong time, and the shareholders of Silicon Valley Bank are really not happy about this. All that told, the dollar, bond yields, the Fed funds rate, all these things that we're looking at are back to levels that were normal before the great financial crisis. We are not seeing things that are abnormal. The only thing that's abnormal is the debt to GDP ratio. The debt to equity ratio is better.
The question really was, do you agree that using the S&P as a proxy for future earnings power is valid? It's two different ways of looking at it. One is a stock to flow and the other is looking at it as a mortgage banker.
We wrote about that, you know, the S&P to the debt, right, that Don referred to is, you know, popularly known as the Warren Buffett metric, right? The Warren Buffett metric is equity market cap divided by GDP. And Warren Buffett has cited this famously, and I agree with it.
Right, but excuse me, but Buffett's a great expert, and you can use his name to get credibility, but comparing market cap of the S&P to GDP is just committing the same sin as comparing debt to GDP. That's an invalid thing to do, even when
we wrote about this in 2018, that if you subtract the debt from the equity at the top, right, the S&P's, the global equity or the U.S. equity market cap, and then compare it to GDP, you find that the debt and basically an enterprise value to EBITDA basis, you end up finding that equities aren't that expensive, is what we found in 2018. And the reason we do that is because it ties back to our initial view of ultimately the debt has to run to sustain 120% debt to GDP. You either need a productivity miracle or you are going to have to run sustained negative real interest rates, which means higher inflation. And then higher negative real interest rates are very good for equities. To be clear, what I'm saying is not dire for equities. It's very good for equities, just not good for bonds. It's very, very good for gold. It's not great for the dollar, but the key is that you say, well, we're getting the productivity, but you just cited, you said the debt to GDP is flat for the last 3 years. If we were having a productivity boom, per your prior point about post-World War II, the debt to GDP would have not stopped falling at 120. It would already be back to 110 or 100 or 90.
What? What? No, no, you don't get to say that. That's not.
You just said that. You said debt to GDP. Hold on. Debt
productivity to GDP is being flat. Productivity is simply it's real output divided by hours worked. It has nothing to do with government debt computation.
If debt is growing as fast as GDP, you're not having a productivity increase.
Productivity does not include debt as part of the calculation. That's just, you're just making up your own definition of productivity. It's not the one that everyone else on earth uses.
What is your calculation? I mean, the productivity. Say it again.
I'm going to use the same one that every economist uses. It's real output divided by hours worked.
Real output divided by hours worked. And what's in real output? 25% of real output is U.S. government spending. And how does the U.S. government fund
its debt? So, you know, by the way, that's actually not true. The productivity statistics provided by the Department of Labor are private sector. They actually exclude government. And if you look at it that way, now I understand. So when I say real GDP, I mean real private output, the private part of GDP. That's the official way of doing it. Now, you could include government. That's fine. You know, it won't look as good because the government isn't as productive as the private sector, but it has its own benchmark. If you go back to the beginning of history and norm it for that, then what you'll still see a productivity boom. You'll just have a lower baseline. But the debt has nothing to do with it.
But if you're having a productivity boom, you should be having a tax receipt boom, which would lead to lower need for the federal government.
You are having a tax receipt boom. Corporate tax receipts right now are higher at a 22% corporate tax rate than the CBO forecast they would be in 2023, back when they thought the rate was going to be 28%.
And yet that the GDP isn't falling.
Yes, it is. It's not. That's just wrong. It's not rising.
Since 1Q23, gross debt to GDP has risen every year since 1Q23.
It's lower than it was 4 years ago.
Well, 4 years ago, but since 1Q23, debt to GDP is up every quarter.
You say it's up. It's up by such a tiny little amount, you'd need a magnifying glass to win your point.
I'm not sure this gets resolved by minuscule changes quarter to quarter on debt to GDP. We're trying to look ahead here, and I would just kind of summarize by saying, Don, you feel like the economic growth will trump the debt issues that Luke is worried about, and I think Luke is saying that those debt issues can only be resolved by continuing inflation. So pretty diametrically opposed, which, as I understand the stats, and you guys are both more way above my pay grade in this, that includes government activity. GDP consists of, I think one of you said, 25% of it is government. So without government being 25% and maybe an increasing amount in future years, you really don't get that GDP growth. The private sector is, maybe it's robust, but is it being eclipsed? I guess this is the question I should ask. Is it being eclipsed by government spending and the need to finance that? So I'm trying to ask an intelligent question here that both of you can respond to.
I think it will be. We had the Eisenhower highway system with government spending help drive massive productivity booms in the 50s and into the 60s and beyond. And I think that type of government spending, if spent on the right productivity enhancing things, and there's signs that some of that might be happening. Some of the energy investments we are making could prove to be driving productivity enhancement, like Don is suggesting, and I agree, may occur. Supporting a war with Russia and Ukraine doesn't drive productivity in the long run. So it depends on our choices, but ultimately, in terms of our choices, the productivity gains depend on our choices, but ultimately, nominal GDP is nominal GDP. And so if you can keep nominal GDP well above the rate of interest, that takes care of the debt problem over time. That is really good for stocks, particularly industrial stocks. That's really good for gold. It's really good for commodities. It's not great for the dollar, and it's good for inflation.
Don, I've never seen you speechless.
May I just interject with one sort of sidelong point, and that is that whatever else we may say about these things, I suspect a point of agreement is that we are in at least a risky or fragile place where, you know, I'm sort of staking it all on saying we can grow our way out of this, but shocks can happen. Things can happen where some event happens in the world where, you know, it's enough of a thing to put you in a recession for a while. And so now you go for two or three or four quarters with contracting or poor growth, but the debt doesn't go away. And, you know, the way politicians act nowadays, if you're in that recession, they're actually going to crank up the debt to get you out of the recession. So I'm sort of self-critiquing here and saying that a vulnerable point in my argument is that it amounts to so far so good, as the man said when he was, you know, passing the 47th window of the Empire State Building on the way down. But, you know, that hasn't happened yet. That is a contingency. But if history is any guide, we do have recessions every once in a while. Let's admit that.
I guess the one last thing on my mind, and that's, you know, because Sprott has a very large faith in the precious metals business. For each of your ideas on why gold is right now trading at an all-time high in U.S. dollars, Don, I don't know how much you've thought about it, but kind of like to get your take on it, if you have one. You don't have to have one, but I'd just be curious.
It's a little bit of a conundrum to me. You know, I'm the kind of guy who likes to sort of tie up events and changes in sentiment and expectations to market moves sort of in real time while they're happening. And I do note that this move by gold to new all-time highs, it's not exactly running away, but it's obviously at new all-time highs. You know, that's a thing. You can't ignore that. That is happening at a time when not so much the Fed, but I think, you know, ordinary market participants are looking at the way inflation's been coming in this year in January and February, and they're thinking, well, is this going to be a replay of 1976 where, you know, it's like Powell has been warning us for the last 3 years, and now it seems like he's almost ignoring his own warning, where he was saying, you know, we don't want to overstay our welcome in this hiking cycle, but on the other hand, we don't want to leave too soon, like Arthur Burns did in December 1976, where you think that your whip inflation now buttons have worked and you've conquered inflation, only to, you know, have to come back 3 or 4 years later and hire Paul Volcker and engineer a double dip recession to really slay the dragon. So here we are with a contracting money supply. So to me, my going in assumption is that the slightly hotter January and February inflation readings are anomalous. They're kind of, you know, one-offy. I guess there have been two of them now. So that's not good. Actually, they're two offy. And while that's been happening, gold's broken out to new highs. But if I'm anywhere near right in believing in what Milton Friedman said in the 60s and 70s, which is inflation is ever and always a monetary phenomenon, you are not going to get an Arthur Burns-style, 1976-style resurgence of inflation like you got when the money supply was growing at 14% year over year, which is what it was doing in December 1976. It is now contracting by 2% a year. So resurgence of inflation, impossible, according to my model. But on the other hand, gold, the price of which is the output of a global supercomputer of the smartest people in the world coming up with their idea of where inflation's going. Well, that supercomputer and my model don't agree right now. So we'll see.
Great. Okay. So that's great, because you're looking at it in terms of the Fed and money supply and Fed policy and all that sort of thing. Luke, what's your thought on why gold is trading at all-time highs in U.S. dollars?
I think there's two reasons to this. Number one, the market is recognizing the United States cannot afford its debt level on a sustained basis with positive real rates. They're going to need to go back to negative real rates and an inflationary policy again, so they're buying gold. And number two, that the BRICS are using gold as their neutral reserve settlement asset for intra-BRIC trade. And The reality is to the extent that is largely driven by commodities, those imbalances among trade are largely driven by commodities, and in particular oil. The oil market is some 12 to 15 times the size of the physical gold market globally. So I think you're going to continue to see a relentless just bid for gold. It may not be really sexy. It may not be a spike, but it's just going to be one of these things where we come in and every week, every month, on balance, gold's going to be higher because effectively BRICS oil is bidding for gold.
Can I just say that if anybody, I have quite a lot of gold. I'm a believer, had it for 40 years. If anyone comes and offers me Venezuelan bolivars for my gold, not selling.
You're a smart guy. I want to thank both of you. I thought that was a great conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Luke. Thank you all.
Absolutely. Thank you, Don. Absolutely. Everyone have a great day.
Well, there you have it, our first Sprott Radio debate. I'd like to echo John and say thank you to our guests today, Don Luskin and Luke Grohman. Both of these gentlemen have websites, and we encourage you to visit them. To find out more about Don's work, head on over to trendmacro.com. And for Luke, go to fftt-llc.com. My name is Stuart Ellis, and thank you for listening to Sprott Radio.
This podcast is provided for information purposes only from sources believed to be reliable. However, Sprott does not warrant its completeness or accuracy. Any opinions and estimates constitute our judgment as of the date of this material and are subject to change without notice. Past performance is not indicative of future results. This communication is not intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any financial instrument. Any opinions and recommendations herein do not take into account individual client circumstances, objectives, or needs, and are not intended as recommendations of particular securities, financial instruments, or strategies. You must make your own independent decisions regarding any securities, financial instruments, or strategies mentioned or related to the information herein. This communication may not be redistributed or retransmitted in whole or in part or in any form or manner without the express written consent of Sprott. Any unauthorized use or disclosure is prohibited. Receipt and review of this information constitutes your agreement not to redistribute or retransmit the contents and information contained in this communication without first obtaining express permission from an authorized officer of Sprott.